good evening. In the news today, public school closures, a new way to fight rats on the New York City subway system, a challenge to New Jersey's teen curfew law, and the nuclear crisis 2 years after the Fukushima disaster. With these and other stories, I'm Linda Perry in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, March 12, 2013. New York's Department of Education panel voted to approve the closure of 22 public schools for what they claim is low performance. The vote came despite four members submitting a proposal to withdraw the current plan, which would have placed a moratorium on the closings. In Manhattan, the DOE's plan for closure includes the High School of Graphic Communication Arts, the Choir Academy of Harlem, the Bread and Roses Integrated Arts High School, and Jackie Robinson. Among schools set to be phased out in the Bronx are PS 50, Clara Barton, PS 64, Pura Belpre, MS 142, John Philip Sousa. Brooklyn was the hardest hit by the plan, with eight schools facing phase-outs or closure. They include the George Gershwin and the Rafael Cordero Junior Highs, Sheepshead Bay High School, and the General D. Chappie James Middle School of Science. The borough of Queens is scheduled to see phase-outs at the Law, Government, and Community Service High School and the Business Computer Applications and Entrepreneurship High School. Under the Bloomberg administration, 142 schools have been shut down or approved for phase-out since 2002, when the mayor came to office. At a preliminary budget hearing of City Council's Committee on Public Safety today, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly testified that the NYPD continues to be understaffed and overburdened. He reiterated concern over illegal weapons, which should be taken off the streets and out of the hands of the city's youth. Brooklyn Councilmember Jamani Williams agrees. He says it would be best if they worked cooperatively.
16-year-olds should not be walking around with guns. The young people
and,
should not be walking around with guns.
Victims in this city, unfortunately, are people
I understand that. I've gone to the funerals where you have not.
What are we doing about
so I know what they look like. I have done a lot about it. And what I would like to see in the budget is impact budget zones, just the same way we have impact. The only response that we can get is police officers. I like to see more responses. I like to see more budget. I like to see more resources. I like to talk to you about policing the community in a manner that's respectful and get to where you want to go. I am very adamant about getting guns off the street. I co-chair the gun violence task force in the city council. We've proposed some things. Thankfully, it's been funded. But if we work together, it will be better than if we work adversarially. Right.
Councilmember Jamani Williams. Manhattan Transportation Authority officials are considering curbing the growing number of rodents in New York City's subway system with a product that induces sterility in female rats. The agency is working with an Arizona-based company that has used ContraPest in agricultural areas of Southeast Asia. Transit officials say the product poses no threats to other animals, crops, or humans and does not leach into water. It will be placed in bait boxes in a handful of subway trash rooms. The New Jersey chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit against the village of Wenatchee, challenging that municipality's teen curfew law. Teenagers in that village and their parents in some cases face fines and community service time if they are caught outside between 10 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. The ACLU lawsuit is on behalf of 17-year-old community college student Shayna Harris, who was cited last September for walking across the street from her home after 10 p.m. to buy a milkshake at a fast food restaurant. WBAI's Jose Santiago discussed the case with Ed Barakas, legal director for the ACLU of New Jersey.
The juvenile curfew here in Wenatchee violates both the juvenile's rights as well as the parent's rights. Here we have a college student, actually, who was arrested for simply walking across the street to get a milkshake at a Burger King because it was after 10 o'clock. All of us have the right to travel, to go to a friend's house, to do what we wish. And even if you're 16 or 17, you still have that right and can't be denied it by the government. A parent can decide to give the child a curfew. And if that curfew is violated, the parent can decide on what the punishment should be. But the government cannot override, cannot insert itself into the role of parent and actually reject what the parent has decided and instead impose its own curfew and discipline on juveniles.
What are the limitations? What are the terms of this curfew?
Well, the curfew basically bans almost all activity for anyone under the age of 18 between 10 at night and 5:30 in the morning. It basically tells them, go to your room and stay there. So if a person, and again, here this we're dealing with someone who received her high school diploma when she was 16 and was now in college at the time that this happened. If she had walked five blocks down the street to meet a friend and walked home at 10:30, or had a study group and walked home at 10:30, or here went out to a fast food restaurant or to a supermarket, they would essentially, under Wanacue's juvenile curfew, be breaking the law.
And what is the penalty, and who is the penalty against, the parents, the young people?
Well, the penalty is against the juvenile, but it also can be against the parent as well. It's a fine, it's community service, and it increases each time a person is found in violation of the ordinance. Mm-hmm. You know, here we have a situation where Shayna's mother was comfortable with her going out to Burger King or to the Stop and Shop. She was comfortable with her being a college student at that age. Surely she could be comfortable with her crossing the street to get something to eat. What the government's really doing here is imposing itself against the will of the parent. The parent has the right to decide, I trust my child, I believe she's responsible enough to do this or that, whatever it might be. Here, Shayna had received permission from a parent to go across the street before she did so.
I'm assuming the curfew was imposed because the authorities there might have had issues with young people out, maybe vandalism or whatever. But do we know if these curfews actually work?
Well, what's interesting is all that this curfew does is criminalize innocent behavior, because Wanacue or any other town already has the ability to arrest people, whether they're young people or adults, for vandalism or trespassing or any other similar actual offense. All that this juvenile curfew does is criminalize innocent behavior and take police resources away from what actually could be useful. Instead, what it does is funnel our young people into the criminal justice system when they shouldn't be.
And my understanding is curfews like this have been imposed in other towns, but a shot down. What's the history?
So the ACLU of New Jersey challenged juvenile curfews back approximately a decade ago, and they were shot down by the courts. In those instances, the courts said that the language of the curfews were too vague, so that it didn't give an accurate explanation to people on what was allowed or what wasn't. What we're doing now raises that vagueness issue, but it's also a direct challenge to these curfews, just as basic violations of the right of juveniles to be free, as well as the right of a parent to decide how to rear their child as they think appropriate and to set curfews as they think appropriate.
So you filed the lawsuit. What's next?
What's next is we filed for an injunction against Wanacue enforcing their ordinance, and we don't have a date yet, but date will be set for that argument, hopefully in short order. We will try to get an injunction so that if Shayna Harris wants to go across the street to get a milkshake at 10:30, or if her mother wants to send her to the supermarket down the street to get milk or bread at night, or if Shayna wants to wake up early in the morning to go for a jog before going off to college classes, she'll be able to do so.
Ed Barakas is legal director with the New Jersey chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. 2 years after the nuclear crisis in Japan, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says American nuclear power plants are safer than ever, though not trouble-free. Watchdog groups call that assessment overly rosy. Members of the scientific and medical profession call it nonsense. In a recent report, NRC Commissioner Allison McFarland says all but five of the nation's 104 nuclear reactors were performing at acceptable safety levels at the end of 2012. But the Union of Concerned Scientists issued a scathing report saying nearly one in six U.S. nuclear reactors experienced safety breaches last year, due in part to weak oversight. The group accused the NRC of tolerating the intolerable. And in New York, a symposium addressing medical and ecological consequences of Fukushima concludes today. Dr. Andrew Cantor is with Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Conference is extremely important because what it is doing is drawing attention to the medical, public health, and ecological consequences of Fukushima, but in the context of the history from Chernobyl, and hopefully to provide a broader understanding of what the impact is of this accident, primarily for us to better understand what the consequences are, but also to hopefully be better judges of what our policies and plans should be for the future, because ultimately it's a question for us what kind of life we want to lead and whether we want to be dependent upon a technology that has these inherent risks.
I hear over and over again about false assumptions.
That's true, and it's mostly because it's natural to have assumptions. You have to have assumptions when doing studies, and it's appropriate to be clear about what those assumptions are. But what we're seeing is a pattern of minimization of these results of these accidents and of these impact of this technology on human and public health. And what we need to be able to do is understand what those assumptions were, and we have clear evidence from this symposium that those assumptions were, let's just say, incomplete, and that it may be important to have an independent, transparent assessment of what these results will be.
At the symposium, Dr. Alexei Yablokov with the Russian Academy of Sciences spoke about the wide-reaching effects of Chernobyl, which affected infant mortality in Germany, in Poland, Finland, Switzerland, and Sweden, and cancer rates in Greece, Romania, and West Berlin. He said, "No country is isolated from nuclear fallout, but not all nations are honest with their populations." The doctor says the nuclear industry is not to be trusted.
We need independent system to detect radiation around every nuclear power plant.
Addressing scientists and members of the medical profession, Yablokov says we have to press the nuclear industry to open real data about everyday releases of radiation from nuclear power plants.
Civil society have to be prepared to battle with nuclear industry, because nuclear industry not so clean, not so good, and dangerous for society.
So do you think there should be a medical registry that monitors each of the nuclear plants in the United States?
Yes, we need medical registry, very important. And every medical registry which we study after Chernobyl in Switzerland, in Finland, in Norway, in Germany, show the Chernobyl impact. The same situation. I am sure it's possible to show here around of nuclear power plant after Fukushima. I know today will be present some data about Fukushima impact on population of United States.
Dr. Alexei Yablokov with the Russian Academy of Sciences. Two young sailors were contaminated by radiation from explosions at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants 2 years after the March 11, 2011 triple meltdowns at the nuclear complex. U.S. sailors who suffered radiation exposure and health damage are telling their story. U.S. Navy quartermasters Maurice Ennis and Jamie Plim, as well as other shipmates, received high doses of radiation while serving aboard the USS Ronald Reagan. The aircraft carrier was supposed to dock in South Korea, But on the eve of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the ship got word of a tsunami and earthquake. They were told they were being rerouted to the coast of Japan to bring food and supplies. There was no mention of a nuclear explosion. The crew was completely unaware that they would be exposed to radiation. They had no protective gear. The USS Ronald Reagan arrived on March 12th, staying as close as 2 miles offshore of the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster.
We never heard anything about a nuclear power plant. We never knew anything about the possibility, let alone any kind of leak.
Jamie Plim was quartermaster on the USS Ronald Reagan.
Our job as quartermasters is not only navigating the ship, driving, plotting our course and track, but going outside at the top of the ship to raise flags, to communicate with other ships. So being outside, we were breathing in this radiation. We were handling flags, which are porous, very porous material, obviously. The ropes that we use to haul the flags up are polyester. So again, a very porous material that just absorbed the radiation.
Few on board knew there were dangerous radioactive plumes blowing in the wind, and no one knew what ocean currents might be contaminated from the destroyed nuclear power plants.
We were outside breathing this in, handling stuff, handling materials, and just absorbing the radiation.
Maurice Ennis was also quartermaster aboard the USS Ronald Reagan.
A part of our job is we have to communicate with other ships using flags and semaphore and Morse code when we're doing special operations. And we store all our flags outside in a weather bag. We also fly our American flag, our ensign, at the highest point so people know we're the U.S. Navy. I was told by one of the higher-ups to go out and retrieve the American flag so we can give it to the Japanese as a friendship type of deal, like a gift. I pulled the flag down. It was flapping when it wrapped around me. It got all over me.
And once Ennis was tested for radiation, it was found that his exposure was the highest of the crew aboard. He was nervous. He was scared.
And they had to remove 3 layers of skin off my hands and my arms. And it wasn't like back to back. They would scrub off 1 layer, and then I would have to wash off this orange grit stuff that you use to get off paint and oil. And then they would do it over again and then check. And we'd start the process all over. So in my head, I was just kind of praying that the machine would stop beeping so I can get it over with. Like, and nobody told me at the time like what was going on. Everybody just kind of told me just to stand there and be quiet and not to touch anybody or anything. It was almost like I had the plague. And finally, the machine stopped beeping and they let me go back to my berthing.
Plim, along with Quartermaster Ennis, did not find out that they were exposed to radiation until a month and a half after the disaster. Ennis has tumors between his eyes, on the side of his face, and on his thighs. He's losing his hair. Plim has what's called dysfunctional uterine bleeding.
When we think about, you know, we don't know what these lumps are, we don't know if we're going to be able to have children, that's the thing that causes us to kind of freak out.
Now the two, along with 115 current and former U.S. military personnel, are filing suit against the nuclear power plant's owner, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company. The suit charges that TEPCO misled U.S. officials about the extent of radiation released. The lawsuit also asks for medical expenses to be paid. And that's our abbreviated news for Tuesday, March 12th, 2013. We are making some progress in setting up a newsroom in a temporary location. Although progress is slow, we expect to bring you a full newscast in the coming days. The news tonight was produced with Rebecca Miles and Jose Santiago. With music by Anthony Grillo, I'm Linda Perry for the WBAI Evening News.